You know, people think I'm cheap. That's ridiculous. There's even somebody cheaper. Here comes the Colonel.
Well, as usual, no respect. I get no respect around here. Welcome back. The second half hour of The Promise of Tomorrow here on the Science News Radio Network. I'm your host. I'm Colonel Mason. We're exploring the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, open innovation. And in just a minute, we're going to get back to our interview with Roger Faulkner. Roger is president and founder, as a matter of fact, of Electric Pipeline Corporation. And he wants to get some interest in L-pipes that are polymer insulated underground high voltage DC conductors based on low cost extruded metal conductors. And quite frankly, his stuff is pretty interesting, and I've got some questions for him on who he hopes to interest in this technology, because he's going to be making his presentation at the IEEE Energy Conference the 27th, 28th, and 29th of September. And if you're interested in more in that, you can go to our website. On the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a link. And if you click on that, it'll tell you all about the program. So, and of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. And but right now, let's step over to our fountain of useless information we have right here on the set. We're so lucky to have this fountain of useless information to answer today's query. How about it, fountain?
Welcome to the fountain of useless information. How can I help?
Okay, old spirit of the fountain, are you ready for this one? Well, what U.S. average soared from 46 in 1900 to 76 at the end of the century? U.S. average soared to the end of the century, the last century. 46 in 1900 to 76 in 1999.
I have given you my answer, and now you may tell me.
Okay, all right, didn't fool you any, did we? The U.S. average soared from 46 in 1900 to 76 in 1999. Why, it was life expectancy. The life expectancy here in the United States. All right, let's get back to our very interesting guest, Roger Faulkner, president of Electric Pipeline Corporation.
So what do you want to have happen? You want somebody like National Grid to put in a test project of this? Or are you looking for the Department of Energy to certify this as a good project and do a test project or a model somewhere or something? What is your goal here?
Those are both things we've looked at, Colonel. And I've applied for ARPA-E funding in round one and again in round three. Alcoa was my co-applicant on both of those ventures.
Oh,
we had other co-applicants as well.
Alcoa, wow.
I thought they were pretty strong applications, but we had good competition too. And in terms of National Grid, I have in fact talked to many utilities. American Electric Power is the one I've talked to the most, but National Grid as well. Utilities are not going to come on board and advocate for this or put money into this until it's well proven. So the people we need to work with to do the proving are back a step from the utilities. For example, right now I'm working with ABB. I have tried with DOE, and I think that in the future I'll probably manage to get some DOE funding. But DOE, EPRI, the Electric Power Research Institute, and suppliers like ABB and Siemens and GE are the logical parties to work with. Right now, I'm angling towards ABB.
So how's progress? I mean, is there going to be a model set up pretty soon where we can see a proof of concept and show how remarkable this concept is?
Well, I am in negotiation, so I don't think I should tell about the stage of the negotiations at this point. But I think I will be successful in getting some preliminary funding or initial funding, and then we will build a model. And after that, the next stage will be to build a demonstration project that might be miles to perhaps hundreds of miles long. Generally, demonstration projects are set up in such a way that they are not critical to the grid. If they go out, they don't cause a big disruption. And then after, there's some soak time. In other words, utilities are very risk averse, as they well should be, and no utility is going to buy an unproven technology. And furthermore, no utility is going to buy anything from a small company, like a startup company like my company. So we basically have to work through a major supplier. And we've realized that from the first. We've now got, we're in negotiations with a very major supplier. ABB is the leading company in the world in HVDC technology. Siemens and ABB are the two leaders. And, you know, we think we're on the right track.
Okay, that's good. Well, it's kind of makes sense when you think about the vulnerability of the power grid. I mean, terrorists come and in a short order could shut down power to millions and millions and millions of customers and corporations and all sorts of different things. And if it's underground, it might be easier to protect. Is that part of the concept?
It is. Some years ago, when I was still pursuing this as a political venture, I tried to raise that issue with Homeland Security and with some congressional aides and didn't have too much success.
Okay.
Everybody wants something that's shovel-ready, and it's not shovel-ready. We do have to have some proving-out phase. On the other hand, the proving-out phase for something based on conventional extruded aluminum conductors and polymer insulators is going to be much shorter than proving out high-temperature superconducting grid elements.
Well, Roger, I want you to keep us up to date on this as you make progress and move along. I guess we're going to see you at the Energy Conference on the 27th, 28th, and 29th in Boston. But when you make some progress and as these things come along, I hope you'll get in touch with us and let us bring everybody up to date.
You bet. You bet. You mentioned the security element, and I don't want to expound on the vulnerability of our present grid too much because you don't know who might be listening, but it is extremely vulnerable. Putting things underground would make it a lot easier to protect. You're absolutely correct about that. The traditional underground power line connections, there are many underlying power connections already. One of the downsides of most existing underground power lines is that it takes a long time to repair them. They're more reliable than overhead lines because they're not taken out by weather disruptions. But when they are taken out, they take longer to repair. It's typical to repair an overhead line in about 4 hours. It's typically 160 hours to repair an underground line. And this is an element of our designs, which is patent pending, where we think we have an advantage. Our electric pipeline is installed on rollers within a conventional pipeline, which looks very much like a gas pipeline. So we've tried to break our construction into several phases. There would be a pipeline that would be laid probably by an existing pipeline manufacturing company, and it would consist of two parallel lines for the plus and minus conductors. They would travel between maintenance vaults, which could be as much as 10 kilometers separated, and then the electric pipeline is sort of snaked into that on rollers. So the pipeline is on carriages, which have rollers and which can be powered, and the entire pipeline segment can be fabricated in the maintenance vault, which is also a clean room, and sort of creeps into this up to 10-kilometer-long conduit. We think that will allow for more rapid repairs if there ever is an outage.
Well, it sounds like you've got it all figured out, and as I say, we're gonna be real interested in progress and how this works for you. Before we get out of here, excuse me. How about giving us a word of wisdom, something for the voice of reason, maybe something that you'd tell a new entrepreneur going into business, or you'd tell somebody graduating from college or something, starting out in life, or a best friend or something like that. What sort of word of wisdom could you give us today?
Well, you can't give up. You know, you get 99 no's and don't give up because you're still looking for one yes. The most important thing is perseverance. Above all, and also listen to other people's advice. Some people are stubborn and they think their ideas are best. I've changed my concepts repeatedly as I've gotten input from people from the utility sector. For example, I really started focusing on the splice issue after I spoke to a man, Lionel Bartholds, who is one of the luminaries in the utility industry. He founded a company, PTI, which is now Siemens PTI, which does systems modeling. And as soon as he saw my earlier designs, he said, you know, you've got on the order of 100,000 splices for a typical project. You know, the reliability of each splice has to be essentially perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And he's absolutely right, and I've focused on that since then. There are plenty of places where that kind of reliability is achieved, including in aircraft, including on computer chips. The methodology of getting that kind of reliability does require that the splices be prepared in a clean room environment. That's even true today for high voltage DC cables that are installed underground at present. For example, when ABB puts in one of their high voltage DC underground cables, they actually set up a mobile clean room, and each splice takes them 24 hours to complete, with two men working 24 hours. So we realized right away that we can't afford that kind of input for each splice because we have 50 times as many splices. So we focused on the splices, and that's the one piece of this technology that we see as real proprietary, is how to make the splices rapidly and reliably.
Okay, Roger, this has been fascinating. I can't tell you how much I really appreciate you being with us today, and I'm so glad you notified us about this technology, because we find it really interesting. And as I say, please stay in touch and let us know how it's progressing.
Well, you bet. Thanks a lot.
To get the view of the Department of Energy on long-range underground electricity delivery, we contacted Rajiv Ram. He's with MIT, but more importantly, he's with the Department of Energy ARPA-E program. That's the Advanced Research Project Agency Energy that you heard Trudy Lehner speak about at the beginning of this program. Is the future going to be underground power transmission? You know, we've never been able to do that effectively, but there's all kinds of talk that it needs to be done. Is that going to be something we have to look forward to?
I think there, you know, I think there is HVDC transmission systems. There are flavors of these transmission systems that actually allow relatively small underground conduits. I think one of the challenges for HVDC is being able to develop component technologies that can allow the cost to be reduced. And actually, that's one of the focus areas for the power electronics program at ARPA-E, is to develop electronics that allow you to switch electricity at the kinds of voltages that HVDC might actually be implemented. So the HVDC systems, again, are typically around 800 kilovolts and above. And so that requires electronics that are actually quite high frequency. Traditional HVDC systems use silicon transistors, a specific kind of transistor, typically IGBT or another kind of switching device called a thyristor. Those are devices that the individual devices themselves typically switch at voltages closer to 6.5 kilovolts. So when you want to switch 800 kilovolts, it requires quite a few of these devices stacked on top of each other. One of the areas that we're investing in ARPA-E is making transistors where an individual transistor can actually switch up at voltages up to 20 kilovolts. And so you can imagine, you know, the transistor circuits that you have in your computer are switching at voltages between 1 and 2 volts. And so you can imagine what it might look like to be able to have a transistor that can directly switch 20 kilovolts and can actually support a megawatt of electricity passing through a single device.
We're talking about 20,000 volts switching. That's and it's DC current you're talking about. Is that right?
Yeah, it can support a DC or AC transmission technology, but in this case, yeah, I'm actually talking about a DC voltage that's actually flowing through that transistor.
It's important, of course, to have a common high voltage DC voltage for the HVDC grid of the future. But there's no economical DC to DC voltage transformers, and is that what you're talking about? How this will solve that particular problem? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's right. So this is actually one of the approaches that you could actually go from one DC voltage to another DC voltage. So it's a problem that's fundamental to HVDC transmission. Is that, for example, if you look at the distribution part of the grid, that's typically AC at 13. Some voltage close to 13 kilovolts. If you want to load onto an HVDC transmission line, you need to have voltages in excess of 800 kilovolts. If you want to do DC to DC transmission, typically that's done by going from DC to AC using a transformer to up that voltage and then going back to DC. Right now, the transformers that you might use in a system like that typically switch, I mean, the AC portion of that DC-DC conversion typically switches at frequencies around 60 hertz. That requires transformers that can be as large as, you know, 10,000 pounds to switch that much energy. If you could if you had electronics that were fast enough at those voltages, you could imagine switching instead of at 60 hertz, switching at, you know, 50 kilohertz. Then all of a sudden your transformer becomes 1,000 times smaller. So you're talking about an electrical power substation that goes from 10,000 pounds to 100 pounds. And so that has significant impact in terms of cost, and actually has there's a national security aspect to that as well. And you can imagine these kinds of substations basically being rolled out throughout the grid, and it might change the way that fundamentally you actually control the grid.
Yeah, that sounds like an effective solution. Now, I understand with a high voltage DC that we can go for long distances, 100 kilometers or so, without refiguring this. Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, that's an example. That is true. So HVDC systems can actually form as the backbone of the grid, and you know, this would basically support the penetration of HVDC systems. So again, the ADEPT program is really focusing on the power conversion that really is an enabler for these kinds of transmission technologies. But it's not really only for enabling these HVDC systems for the grid backbone. You can imagine these kind of advanced power converters really helping to deliver electricity directly to the neighborhood that you live in. And so they're actually they're compatible not just with HVDC systems and enabling for that technology, but you know they're also useful for AC transmission systems. So they're FACTS devices, flexible AC transmission systems that are used to essentially route electricity on the existing AC grid. And today those devices are quite expensive, and as a result they're really only deployed at congestion points in the electricity grid. And you can imagine if you have the appropriate lower cost power converter technology, you could imagine deploying FACTS technology throughout the grid, and that would support the greater penetration of renewables. It would make the grid more stable potentially, and more controllable.
So is that what we have to look forward to then? Is it going to be largely underground cables? We're going to get away with all the aerial stuff then in the future?
Well, I think we're looking at underground HVDC transmission really as a backbone transmission technology. Changing the entire utility grid is a multi-trillion-dollar infrastructure investment. And so what we're trying to do is really enable the fundamental technology, allowing people to make the appropriate choices for the type of grid that they need.
So it wouldn't be a matter of replacing the existing grid. What you're talking about is in new delivery of electricity to places that don't want to have overhead cables. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, that's a possibility. So again, the focus of the program at RPE is not to be a proponent for one particular type of grid topology. The focus is really to be able to provide the enabling hardware to support a whole host of different grid technologies. So that means being able to support easy upgrade for the existing grid to make that more flexible and controllable, as well as being able to support some of these newer ideas like HVDC systems that can be underground.
What about the superconducting cables? What can you tell us about the new superconducting material that is replacing copper?
So right now within ARPA-E, we basically are not. There's not a focus in particular on superconducting cable technology. There is a GRIDS program, which is on grid-level storage, and one of the storage approaches is looking at superconducting magnetic energy storage. And there's a program that was announced a few weeks ago that is actually focused on that technology, but looking at long-scale distribution of electrical power over superconducting lines. That isn't a program within RPE currently.
Well, aren't there some serious problems with superconducting systems that it has to work perfectly in one microsecond of too much current, and it crashes dramatically, and that makes it very unreliable? What can you say about that?
Yeah, I mean, we haven't looked at that specifically as a technology. I mean, currently, right now, again, if we look at the programs that are within RPE, they basically span the entire in terms of the discussion that we're having today. The two programs that we have that complement the utility grid are one on the power conversion, which we've been discussing, and one on the grid level storage, which I mentioned in terms of this superconducting storage. Other than that, we really have the RPE's purview is quite broad. So we have programs in building energy efficiency, primarily looking at advanced air conditioning systems, looking at new versions of biofuels, the electrofuels program. More efficient batteries for electric vehicles, looking at carbon capture storage technologies. So it's a very broad portfolio. And so what that means is we're not able to look at everything in the little over a year that the agency's been in place.
Well, you just named a whole menu of really fascinating things that we could get deeply into. Can you tell me anything about ultracapacitors? Is there a place for that? Those in what you're doing?
Yeah, so there are several capacitor programs currently underway within RPE. So, just a little bit of background. The RPE when it was. The first funding opportunity that RPE had was a very broad funding opportunity. It was basically trying to capture a snapshot of the energy research landscape within the United States. Several of the programs that were funded in the original in that original funding opportunity included programs on ultracapacitors. One example is a program of a company called FastCap, which is looking at advanced carbon nanostructures to be able to make ultracapacitor systems. In the power electronics program, there's also obviously a focus in the capacitor space. The capacitors for electronic applications, quite a large market, in the neighborhood of about $17 billion a year annual market.
Well, Dr. Rahm, it seems we're out of time, but we hope you'll return real soon and tell us more about this.
And now, we make time for the voice of reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
I'm hoping that our younger generation works fervently for society's benefit. And now I'm going to tune this to power and energy, because it feeds so much of our development, our economic development. Power generation is directly linked to human development index, and there's so many people around the world that we tend to forget living here in the United States that have very low economic development. And for them to develop, they're going to need good access to energy resources and eventually to electricity production. And, we have to think not just of what we're doing here in the United States and in the industrialized countries, but what's happening in India and Bangladesh and Africa and China. And between India and China, with their huge populations and growing populations, if we don't help solve this problem of energy resources and climate change, then they're going to suffer the most. The poorest people in the world will suffer the most. And that's why I am interested in working in this area. And I encourage other young people to do it as well. This is Joseph Minervini. I'm a senior research engineer at the MIT Plasma Science and Fusion Center.
So you decide. Has this really been the voice of reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
Waiting for you.